communist challenge is not new. This is South Vietnam. In the years after 1946, French forces struggled to maintain their influence against the tide of communist-led Vietnamese forces pressing from the north.
The French army had been in Indochina since the middle of the 19th century. The regular army and the legendary legionnaires exerted its considerable power to enforce the authority of the colonial government, extinguishing countless acts of rebellion intended to destabilize the French hold on the region. That grip began to loosen in May of 1940 when Hitler unleashed upon the Low Countries and France Blitzkrieg.
For the Führer, this was the greatest prize he had yet captured. In a matter of days, the German army was rolling through the French countryside toward Paris. Germany's traditional enemy now lay at the feet of the gloating Nazi Superman.
After 6 weeks of fighting, the British Army was thrown into the sea. France, under World War I hero General Henri Philippe Pétain, signed an armistice in the same train where Germany was forced to lay down its arms in 1918. Pétain was the head of French government in southern France, wholly dependent on and collaborating with Germany. Early in 1940, Ho Chi Minh returned from Paris to Vietnam to become the leading figure in the Indochinese Communist Party and its military arm, the Viet Minh. This military force was formed to fight the French troops in Southeast Asia, but soon was confronted by another, more dangerous foe.
Out of this meeting between two unscrupulous warrior nations, bent on destruction of the existing world, came an agreement that Germany would not interfere with Japan's designs on Indochina and Thailand.
On August 30th, 1940, the Matsuoka-Henry Pact was signed by the puppet Vichy government and the Empire of Japan. This pact permitted the Japanese to station troops in French Indochina. The French colonial administration now was merely window dressing for the Japanese army. To Ho Chi Minh, it made no difference as to who the occupying army was. They were still forcing their rule upon his people. Ho had preached national independence, and now was the time for his nationalist army to strike a blow for that independence. With the help of arms from the U.S. and training support from the Office of Strategic Services, better known as the OSS, he invited all the region's revolutionary forces to unite under his command in the fight against the occupying armies of Japan and France. Ho Chi Minh's Viet Minh led a no-holds-barred fight against the Japanese in Southeast Asia. The death toll on both sides was appalling. Far away from the jungle battles, a death blow was struck against the Japanese Empire that brought the fighting to an end. Thank you. September 3rd, 1945, in Tokyo Bay, Japan surrenders to the Allies. But even before the ink was dry on the surrender document, the groundwork for a new conflict was being laid in Southeast Asia. As the Japanese troops in Vietnam are laying down their arms, Ho Chi Minh takes advantage of the power vacuum left by the defeated Imperial Army. He proclaims himself to be the only political authority for the nation and creates the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. But the French have other ideas. In Paris, General Charles de Gaulle, anxious to restore French sovereignty in Indochina, sends a 70,000-man expeditionary corps under the command of General Philippe-François-Marie Leclerc to regain control of the Asian colony. Leclerc makes some effort to compromise with Ho Chi Minh, but in the end, the Viet Minh once again pick up arms and the long war in Vietnam begins. For 160 years, they fought for France in places most Frenchmen would like to forget. At one time, an army of rogues and thieves, they became heroes.
In 1954, the Geneva Conference decided that fate. In a compromise decision, the conference divided Vietnam into two parts. In the north, it conceded Viet Minh communist control. In the south, it provided for free elections, for a free people who rejected communism. After 1954, communist Viet Cong renewed their assault on South Vietnam in direct violation of the Geneva Conference's ceasefire agreement. Viet Cong tactics were closely patterned after those successfully practiced by the Chinese communists. Well-trained, well-equipped guerrillas, backed by political commissars and agitators, struck out. They terrorized the cities, sabotaged rails and transportation, blew up bridges, attacked the villages, and melted back into the jungle.
The French Foreign Legion was unlike any other 20th century military force in the world. An army of mercenaries whose sense of honor transcended national boundaries. These were the orphans of the French Republic and the spearhead of the Republic's armed response to the Vietnam uprising. Few military units pride themselves on battles that were ultimately lost. But for the men of the French Foreign Legion, pride and honor are more important than victory and defeat. This tradition was never more tested than at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. France was losing the war for Indochina. Since the defeat of Japan in 1945, French troops and colonial administrators attempted to reassert control of France's Asian empire. It proved to be a costly and futile exercise. For 8 years, France attempted to subdue the stubborn coalition of communist guerrillas and Vietnamese nationalists who vowed to expel all foreigners from their country. This was no war to win the hearts and minds of the people. It was a brutal war of attrition, a war perfectly suited to the Legion. In total, nearly 30,000 legionnaires were deployed, an army that was expected to quash the Asian rabble. The motto of the Legion was Legio Pastoria Nostra, the Legion is my father. The men's loyalty is to each other and to their officers for whom they march or die. And in Vietnam, they died by the thousands. In spite of their courage, the Legion's climactic battle for Southeast Asia at Dien Bien Phu is considered a classic example of how not to wage war. In November of 1953, France foolishly deployed the majority of its forces in a vast basin totally surrounded by jungle-clad hills held by the enemy Viet Minh. All winter, undetected by French commanders, preoccupied with minor ground skirmishes, the enemy advanced. The Viet Minh covered the hills with hundreds of cannons and tons of ordnance, carried on their backs the steep slopes. To deliver the killing blow, tens of thousands of men infiltrated the hillside, placing the French base under constant rifle fire. From the beginning, the French lacked sufficient manpower and equipment to do more than hold on. Yet the fighting dragged on through the spring of 1954.
The climactic struggle for Dien Bien Phu enters its second month with airborne reinforcements shuttled to the beleaguered garrison, where paratroopers drop to a fate that remains in the balance. The picked contingent hits the ground and goes into action immediately with machine gun and mortar fire. Operation Castor takes the pressure off the original defenders of the garrison, whose name has become military legend. Throwing air superiority into the struggle, all possible cover is provided before monsoons ground planes. Outnumbered 4-1, they repulse attacks. Both sides fight to the last ditch for Dien Bien Phu.
As the climactic struggle for Dien Bien Phu entered its second month, airborne reinforcements were dropped into the beleaguered base. The paralegions hit the ground and went into action immediately through a never-ending hail of machine gun and mortar fire. The legionnaires, who had gladly volunteered to parachute into the battle, knew that there was no way out. No evacuation was possible, and by tradition, legionnaires never surrendered. The men fought until there was no more ammunition, no more bodies to absorb the relentless shrapnel raining from the skies above. On May 8, 1954, the fortress fell. 8,000 legionnaires were dead. The fall of Dien Bien Phu marked the end of the French War and the beginning of America's longest conflict. The origins of America's commitment of ground troops to Indochina can be traced to a warm October day in 1961, in the first year of John Kennedy's brief presidency. President Kennedy had come to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, primarily to review the 82nd Airborne and to get a feel for the power of an American division with all its might and in all its glory. The young commander-in-chief also had another, more pressing reason for the visit to the base. He had also come to witness what the Army's newly created small elite fighting force could do. This force was the Army's special forces.
Now I'm down there standing at attention with the 82nd Airborne Division all out on Pope Air Force Base, and the president's driving by checking us out. Here's John Kennedy going by, and everybody's supposed to be staring straight ahead in the back of the head and in front of you, and everybody, the pride that we had for him. And I wrote, told my father, I said, Dad, I said, I'm not supposed to do it. You're supposed to be looking straight ahead. But I looked up, and Jack Kennedy's, we had eye contact. And to me, that was, oh, it couldn't get any better. 19 years old and a kid that was almost in jail. Now I'm looking at the President of the United States.
It was a proud moment for a 19-year-old trooper and his special forces comrades. They wanted to demonstrate that pride with the headgear of their brotherhood. In the Army of the 50s and early 60s, distinctive uniforms for elite troops was strictly forbidden. But on the 12th of October, green berets of every variety were taken from their hiding places and placed on freshly shaved heads. On this day, for the first time at an official function, the Special Forces troops wore the cherished symbol of their brotherhood. The Green Beret.
These are guys who can put it together with good state of mind, and they're smart. And they're able to put the two together. I think it takes a special kind of guy.
From that day forward, the Army Special Forces would be known by friend and foe alike by their distinctive headgear. It wasn't surprising that JFK would place his blessings upon the Maverick Special Operations Unit. To the young president, they were glamorous, and these were the most glamorous days of Camelot. But in addition to the glamour, Special Forces had the potential to do things that Kennedy wanted to accomplish. And those things were outlined in his inaugural speech in January of that year. His words were a call to arms for the free world.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
The Special Forces would be the spearhead to defend that vision of superpower foreign policy, a steel bolt to strike swiftly and silently on Third World battlefields where the Cold War was heating up. In the late 50s and early 60s, the Cold War was nowhere hotter than in Southeast Asia.
'61, and we were recruited, all of the aviators were recruited to go to Vietnam and fly for a segment of the government. The Army had not been inserted into Vietnam in 1961-62 time frame. They were using military assets to fly for Air America on logistics missions and things like that.
To combat these forces, the U.S. needed to develop a new kind of warrior.
The officers need to understand. They need to go to school and understand the culture that they're within. They need to be able to recognize things that might not play well. The way you treat villages, the way you act. You may be thinking that you're being polite, really not. Those sorts of things that the officers need to know. I don't think the enlisted men really do need to know that. From a special forces point of view, though, they do need to know that, and they do know that, and they did know that in Vietnam. That's all those famous pictures that I guess was Life magazine did of Vernon Gillespie in 1962 and 63. Probably seen them playing with the children in the Montagnards. This is the sort of things they were taught to do, and they did it very well. Special forces, and special forces still does that. That's why we have groups, special forces groups that are devoted to one area.
The old concept of an SF warrior as fire-breathing commando had to be rethought. The new Special Forces warrior had to be politically and psychologically sensitive to the environment where he operates. But before you could create the perfect super soldier, you had to build the foundation of the fighting man. Jump and Ranger School became the 101 courses for building the warriors of Special Ops. The future warriors came to jump school for a variety of reasons. For some, like Larry Riley, it was a youthful impulse.
I was an 18-year-old kid, a 17-year-old kid at this time, and I wanted to be a paratrooper, okay? So there's not a lot of thought to it.
For others, it was a chance to get out of a messy situation.
I got in some trouble that summer of 60. And the officer that was talking to me knew my father, and he said, why don't you do something with your life, and you ever thought about the service? What was ironic is in basic training, it's all new and you're just a recruit. I was on mess hall duty in KP, and I heard the first sergeant out in the background in the company area saying, anybody who was going airborne, fall out, do the airborne PT test. You still have to physically qualify for the airborne. So I said, mess sergeant, I'm... I'm supposed to be airborne. I'm going out there. Of course, I don't know if he knew. He probably thought I was trying to sandbag and get out of mess hall duty. But I'm missing my opportunity here. I'd already been rejected by the Navy. Plus, I was too mean, I guess. And then, anyway, he said, you're in the mess hall. He said, you can go airborne later. You're in my mess hall now. Keep washing them pans.
Since the dark days before America's entry into World War II, this was the toughest training any American fighting man could face.
Ah, jump school. It's hell, I'll say that. They talk about Hell Week in the Navy, but boy, they, you know, every time your left foot hits the ground, you holler airborne, and everything's done at a double time, and they're trying to weed out who really doesn't have the heart to stay there.
Endless physical training, hard discipline, and the danger of jumping out of a perfectly good airplane. This was the furnace that tempered the steel that would be the sword of American foreign policy in the Third World.
Immediately, you will be a casualty. And you're doing us no good. We have to put you in an old pine box because you didn't use your noodle. You'll be exposed to pain and punishment and other little devices that we'll think of for one reason and one reason only. To make you the type of person we need to get the job done, no matter what the job is.
The Special Forces training process began in what is called the Q course, held at the Smoke Bomb Hill area of Fort Bragg. The Q course is a mixture of classroom training and field activity with the weight on field. The basic unit in Special Forces is the A-Team. There are only 12 people in an A-Team.
Generally on an A-Team, you would have a demolitions guy, you would have a communications guy, you would have a language guy, you have a medic. Who's almost the equivalent of a doctor, a medic that could perform surgery. At Fort Bragg, there's a great demonstration of some of the skills of Special Forces. I'd be impressed. Not every member of Special Forces can do what the next guy can do. You're cross-trained. You're always cross-trained. But, I mean, there are guys who could just break into anything. They could take a padlock and tap it with their fingernail and it'd fall open.
Each member of the team is cross-trained in a number of jobs vital to completing the team's mission many miles behind enemy lines. Among the team, there is no discrimination because of rank. If your mission falls into one of your specialties, you are in charge.
I remember, well, basic training, you know, like sergeant's the sergeant, you know, and the officers are like, you know, they're way up there, you know, like all you do with officers is salute, stand at attention, and say yes, sir. But then when you got into group, there was a mutual respect for ability and talent. I use the word talent because they did find in each individual something that you really know how to do. And they put that to work. And the officers showed a lot of respect to the enlisted men. So the enlisted men, obviously. And in combat, you know something? It really doesn't matter what rank you are. If you're a jerk, you can be fragged. It doesn't matter how many stars you have on your shoulder. If you're mistreating other guys, the chances are good that some of them will consider, I'm not going to let this guy pick on you. But there's a lot of respect for officers because they knew what they were doing, and they knew that we knew how to do what we were supposed to do.
In the Vietnam era A-Team, each soldier had to be an expert marksman with the basic weapon of the U.S. infantry, his M-16, and with any enemy weapon he may encounter on the battlefield. He had to not only know how to fire them, but also how to maintain, modify, and repair each weapon.
They were given special training, superpowers, you might say. Knowledge is power.
After a week of primary instruction, the teams moved into the field for 2 weeks of hands-on training. The A teams would form up to deploy in enemy country. The teams were expected to contact indigenous people and turn them into guerrillas. These were usually played by soldiers of support units from Fort Bragg who dressed as civilians. They would then take these units to blow up bridges and communication centers, as well as set up ambushes and develop civil affairs work aimed at winning the hearts and minds of the people.
Under ambush, the riflemen start shooting, whether you're on foot or in a truck, deuce and a half or a three-quarter ton truck, the riflemen start shooting at you. So the natural tendency is to jump for cover to the other side, maybe into a buffalo hole where they used to waller, you know, to cool off a little bit, a water buffalo. And as soon as you do that, then the machine gun is on you. So the only option really is to go for the live fire. You go directly into the rifleman. It's almost generally a no-win situation. So that was in preparation for the types of ambushes that we would experience. But we, because of the guerrilla operations, rarely experienced ambushes except in long distance travel.
Better to get killed at Bragg than get killed for keeps in Nam. Soldiers who completed this successfully were rewarded with the cherished flash on their green beret.
These were badasses. You know, look, they're not all 300 pound guys who look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, a lot of brains in special forces. And a lot of times on an A team, although you do have, you have to meet certain physical requirements. A lot of it is brains over brawn.
It was now time to put all that training to the test.
My darling Mick, today has been another long day at Mong Su, Laos, but at least it's ended and I'm that much closer to being with you and Robin once again. You know, I actually enjoy this tour of duty so long as I'm busy enough to keep my thoughts from wandering back to you. Our mission's classified, but I do think we are making a difference. Captain Joe Bush, advisor to Laotian Forces, Mong Su, Laos.
Special Forces had a long history in Southeast Asia. In July of 1959, 12 U.S. Special Forces teams from the 77th Special Group were sent to Laos to clandestinely organize and train the Laotian Army. The Green Berets arrived in the country wearing civilian clothes with fake identification and were paid out of civilian funds from CIA bank accounts. In addition to training, these teams also had to find a way to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail that ran through Laos into South Vietnam. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was not a single route south, but a spiderweb of trails and footpaths that communist forces used to supply cadres throughout Southeast Asia. By 1961, the political situation in Laos had reached a boiling point. Fighting between communist insurgents, competing warlords and ethnic struggles, with their roots going back generations, coups and counter-coups were beginning to unhinge American foreign policy in Southeast Asia. According to the domino theory, President Kennedy had to do something about Laos. Early in 1961, U.S. Special Forces were officially admitted into Laos. They could wear their uniforms and were designated by U.S. Military Assistance Advisory Group Laos, or MAG Laos, as White Star Mobile Training Teams.
Special Forces were sent to Laos as part of an operation called White Star. And I think that's probably where they got the early lessons learned, if you will, for what would become their role in Vietnam. The first the first groups that went in were under civilian cover, and they were just supposed to look around and see what they found. They found the obvious, which was that the communists were all over the country, that there was a real, there was going to be a real problem. And the special forces then went in as part of Kennedy administration's military commitment to Laos. There's still a limited amount of special forces that went in as trainers, and the sort of things that became the rule in Vietnam.
These new teams were the spearhead of the thousands of troops to be sucked into Vietnam. The mission of these White Star teams was to instruct Laotian troops in counterinsurgent tactics. But not all activity was limited to the classroom. Some of the teams provided in-the-field assistance in the form of communication services, gathering of intelligence, and creating strike forces among the minority hill people of Laos. It was with this last mission that the White Star teams made their lasting contribution. In late 1961, the Pathet Lao controlled the strategic Balovan Plateau in southern Laos. Ka hill people mostly inhabited this area in the Laotian Panhandle region. The Ho Chi Minh Trail ran between the plateau and the Vietnamese border. The mission of the Green Beret was to organize, arm, and train the Ka tribesmen into guerrilla bands that could drive the Pathet Lao off the plateau and cut the trail. The Special Forces advisors often found themselves in the middle of some of the most desperate fighting in all of the war. These desperate fights were the first trial by fire of the young Berets. They also etched the first names into the black granite wall that would become the stark symbol of America's sacrifice in Southeast Asia.
Dear Mick, only 2.5 more months to go. From all that's happening in Little Laos, it seems that I will keep quite busy. It looks like I will have 6 new ribbons on my uniform when I come home. All of that's classified, but if all of the paperwork gets completed, I will receive a little recognition for a generally thankless job. They want me to extend my tour, but baby, I have to get out of this place. Don't worry, old Joseph will be home to his wife and daughter as planned, even if I have to swim the Pacific. Your own, Joe.
Captain Joseph Kerr Bush, Jr., military advisor to Laotian forces, was killed 5 days later during an NVA commando attack. He was 25 years old. The Special Forces advisors did save the villages from a communist takeover, but failed through no fault of their own to sever the communist supply trails. The attacks on the trail itself were never accomplished.
Again, there were two wars going on, and the center of gravity for the main force war is the base areas. And in any war situation, you have to go for the center of gravity. We didn't do it. Center of gravity for the insurgency is the infrastructure. We waited too long to go after it. If we'd done those two things early on, it would have been a much different war than it turned out to be.
By 1962, the U.S. reached an agreement with the communists to stabilize the situation in Laos. This agreement ended any hope of cutting the Ho Chi Minh Trail and gave free access to supplies to communist forces in the south for the next decade. Supplies that would be used to end the lives of over 55,000 young Americans.
Dear Dad, I'm writing this letter to you at your office because I want you to tell Mom in your own words. I don't think writing home would get anything straight. Well, here it is. We've been told that our whole company will be shipping to Vietnam. The only thing that makes me mad is how do they expect you to tell your parents? They act as though it's an everyday experience and that we should feel the same way. Robert Devon, 71st Infantry Detachment.
By 1960, Viet Cong insurgency in South Vietnam began to grow at an increasing rate. The Viet Cong were battle-hardened veterans. Some had fought this type of war on the same ground against both the Japanese and later the French colonial army. For U.S. forces, this is going to be a very different war from the one they spent a decade training for.
We were now in Vietnam. It was a counterinsurgency. The enemy was hidden. The enemy didn't fight from fixed installations. The enemy didn't wear uniforms. The enemy fought at night. The American forces didn't fight at night. All of the things that we had been taught about fighting an enemy that was on a European battlefield, particularly for an armor officer, it didn't work in Vietnam.
But there was one group of U.S. warriors ready for the coming fight.
Part of the groundswell within the Kennedy administration is over this new notion of counterinsurgency. And the obvious choice for counterinsurgency are warriors who are sort of like the insurgents themselves. In this case, it's the Green Berets, Special Forces. So there's a very public push in 1960, mostly, beginning, within the Kennedy administration to send Special Forces to Vietnam to fight the guerrilla as a guerrilla, if you will. And the perception of the war began to change with the reality on the ground, which in this case was this fairly, 1960, a low-level guerrilla war with insurgents that are very much able to stay away from the main force, South Vietnamese units, and do a lot of damage and gain a lot of support within the countryside. Special forces were seen as a way to try to get to thwart that. And the idea was exactly as they had been planned in Europe, to send them behind enemy lines, in this case just into the countryside in Vietnam, and to try to garner support for the government by living with the people, offering programs that would make their lives better, and at the same time training them to defend themselves.
Just months after President Kennedy's visit to Fort Bragg, the Special Forces was in Vietnam to implement a CIA plan to stem the Viet Cong tide in the central highlands of Vietnam. The program was called Civilian Irregular Defense Group, CIDG program.
We had 200 officers were in the class, and we had about 30 who had been in Vietnam in 64 as advisors. And they really were starting to rewrite all of the lesson material. We would have these officers, these returnees, would stand up and talk to us. So that it was very, because everybody was going to go to Vietnam in 66. Anybody that hadn't been was going to go. So as an aviator, I knew I would go over and fly. And so it was very important that we learned as much as we could from these fellas that had returned about life in Vietnam. There were no books.
The goal of this operation was to deny the VC access to food, supplies, recruits, and intelligence. They hoped to block the North Vietnamese Army, NVA, access to Vietnam from the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This was the rejected agency proposal from Laos. The highlands were inhabited primarily by an assortment of minority groups and primitive tribes, collectively called Montagnards, mountain people. The Vietnamese people thought they were savages and held the Montagnards in great contempt. This distrust would hinder counterinsurgency in the highlands, which is exactly what the CIA intended to do.
In the beginning, I think, is the early 60s, part of the mission of the Green Berets was, you know, to go to the hills, to meet with these tribes, and to try to convince them to support the government of South Vietnam. But as you approach the Montagnards and you talk to them about the government, they would say, what government? You mean that guy who comes and steals my water buffalo? Taxes. The Montagnards had seen too much of it. VC running through. And they were largely, like so many people in Vietnam, victimized by the VC run through, and if you don't give us rice, if you don't let us use your facilities, which, what facility? Basically water. Food and water. Then you're our enemy. Well, then the RVNs come in, the South Vietnamese Army comes in and sees that, and even the American Army comes in and sees that, and they're suddenly guilty of harboring the enemy. They didn't harbor the enemy. Same thing we learned later in years in El Salvador and in Central America. The peasants were victimized by the war. But the Montagnards were especially strong people.
The CIDG program was run by the CIA and American Special Forces and was loosely connected to the Strategic Hamlet program. Although the program was conceived and funded by the CIA, the strategy and operation fell to the Green Beret. In November of 1961, two Special Forces A teams were deployed from the 1st Special Forces Group. The A team established a base in an area and began to win the trust of the local villagers. They then helped them prepare a defense system against the local Kong cadre and NVA forces. The Green Berets also recruited and trained local men to form a strike force designed to provide a full-time offensive force. This force would provide reinforcements to area villages under attack, patrol trails in the area, and set ambushes for the VC. Once the SF had established an effective strike force, they would begin to organize and train village defenses. These groups received basic training in weapons handling and were taught to defend and fortify their homes. They fought only when their village was under attack. Each village was provided with a radio that allowed them to contact the Green Berets and the local strike force. The strategy was simple, the results remarkable, and the heroism of both the Green Berets and the mountain people unmatched. The degree of the heroism was demonstrated in places like Pleiku.
They held out. But I think the guys at Pleiku saw it the worst.
The Special Forces had established a base of operations near a strategic branch of the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
I think that was the ultimate goal, was to try to get in there and probably within 4 to 5 months have something in there, like a fixed fire base or a road or something. Well, we continued to gather intelligence, and we continued to get shot at.
The U.S. troops and their Yard strike force were determined to cut this enemy supply line. The VC and the NVA were just as determined not to let this happen.
They had discipline. They wore uniforms. They would stand and fight.
The Viet Cong and NVA regulars assaulted the Green Beret fire base with a fury unseen to date in the war. This was no longer guerrilla warfare. It was an old-fashioned siege.
89 days. And they were just swamped by swarms.
The small strike force called in every asset it had.
Roger, that's the target area there.
It was tough because we didn't do a lot of fighting at night, and they did. We would hunker in. We would go into defensive posture at night. We would ring in. We would tighten, gather the wagons. We would try to do the best we could, send out listening, the posts, devices, you know, be within earshot, do all this kind of stuff, flares. But no great assaults. We reacted. We weren't trained to fight. But they did. They were unstructured, and they did a hell of a job, and they would infiltrate, and they would get into our britches and in our face, unseen, and unsighted, and unsmelled, and blow our buns off.
And when bad weather grounded their air support, they called on sheer guts alone to hold out.
They were working with the Moniards. They ran out of ammunition. And they're throwing rocks. They're throwing anything they could find. If there was a coat hanger on the ground, it got put to use. And they held out. They held out. That was nasty. But you're talking like, I can recall, I don't believe I slept for 2 months one time, if that's possible. I mean, I did lie down, hugging my weapon all the time. But if you can sleep with one eye open, I did it.
It's just the idea when you see what I saw and all of these soldiers fighting gallantly. I mean, I don't want to get overly excited and teary, but these were kids. But it was a tough time. It was tough for everybody.
Bloody and battered, the Green Beret and their Yard strike forces held out and broke the back of the assaulting column. The success of the A-teams was so extraordinary that by April 1962, 40 villages in Darlak province were under the protection of the CIDG program. By May 1962, 8 more teams were ordered to Vietnam. By July, the CIA was so pleased with the success that the agency requested 16 more teams for deployment. But if the agency was pleased, the communists were not. They feared and respected the Special Forces warriors so much that they even resorted to offering bounties to villagers and guerrilla fighters to stop the berets. You didn't even have to turn in a whole American.
We compared it to a $10,000 bounty. If you bring me the head of a Green Beret, you get $10,000. So there was that constant concern about not losing your head.
Overall, the CIDG program was operating very well. In just 1 year, the Special Forces and their Montagnards forces had denied the Viet Cong access to the local population and the resources of food and shelter. But sometimes, the enemy was closer than you expected.
Up around Plaque Hill, I had some buddies who were sitting there. They weren't Special Forces. They Signal Corps. They were to build a communications tower. And they were on TDY, temporary duty. And there about 4 months. And for 4 months, there was a Vietnamese lady in the camp who would wash their clothes, cook them special foods, bring them special favors. And when they left, when they were to return to wherever their base was outside of Vietnam, in the back of a 3/4-ton truck, and she, as they drove, pulled away, she came running up to them with a gift, and she handed them the gift, and it was a grenade, and it went off. So this is after like months of monosyllabic, and the one to take care of you, make your coffee. So they were in place. They were in place for a long time, and they were everywhere. And identifying them was literally impossible. Even in camps where it was considered secure, they generally knew that among some of the nationals, some of those nationals were VC.
Sadly, the powers in Washington could not stand their own success. They were about to order a change to special operations in Vietnam that would alter the Shadow Warriors' mission and the nature of the war.
There's a high-flying bird way up in the sky, and I wonder, does he look down as he flies on by, riding on the air so easy in the sky? But Lord, look at me, I'm rooted like a tree.